And welcome back. The next 2 hours are going to be fascinating for a number of reasons. This is our umpteenth extensive special on Morgellons syndrome, Morgellons disease, Morgellons affliction, Morgellons whatever you want to call it. It is something that is clearly spread all around the world, carried by unknown numbers of people, perhaps millions, perhaps hundreds of millions. We don't know. But for those of you interested and who may not be up to speed on this, look at the left-hand side of Rents.com and you'll find a very large section on Morgellons. Two people will be with us tonight to talk about some very interesting new developments. First up, I'm going to bring on the male half of this duo. He is Cliff Mickelson. Cliff has had Morgellons for nearly 15 years now and has been working tirelessly to try to help educate as many people as possible. Cliff has been on this program many, many times before. He's a remarkable human being for many reasons, not the least of which is that he has survived and has overcome much of the Morgellons devastation and lives a very productive and remarkable life. Welcome back, Cliff. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Glad to hear your voice. Where are you, south or north?
Well, I'm south.
All right.
I'm down here in Mexico right now.
All right. Well, you sound good. You must have found batteries at the Radio Shack store.
Yes, I did. I've got them charged up, and we're good to go.
All right. Very good. Now, the other guest is a very special friend of this program and friend of the planets. Her name is Jan Smith. Jan also has been suffering from Morgellons syndrome for many years, close to about the same time in years that Cliff has been battling it. But the real amazing thing about Jan Smith is that she is, not unlike Clifford Carnicom, someone I call a hero citizen scientist. Jan really began doing the first serious, outside-the-box, open-to-the-public, for everybody, research on Morgellons of anyone I've ever heard of, and I don't think anyone can even come close to the contributions she has made. Her images, her data, the research she has personally over countless hours made public have been picked up by all kinds of different websites, hustlers, hucksters, frauds, phonies, and some good legitimate people as well. Her work is quite literally, in many ways, if not the backbone of much of Morgellons as we understand it to be. And we don't get this from the government. We get it from people like Jan Smith and Cliff Mickelson. Jan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Glad you're back. What we're going to hear tonight, after I do some preliminaries, is some remarkable new research material that Jan Smith has discovered. It is not the whole answer. It is certainly a very important part of the puzzle, one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle that I think we have nailed down now since this whole nightmare began. It's extraordinary, and you'll see it at Rents.com under guests and so forth. Let me go back to Cliff just for a couple of minutes here. Where are we now, Cliff, in the year 2010, and when did you first come down with this nightmare situation?
Well, it's been approximately 15 years. It took a few years to realize what was going on, but this particular affliction has a tendency to mimic other things, and so people don't really realize what it is they have, and I was one of them. For a long time, I was confused as to what I was being afflicted with, and I was able, in retrospect, to pin it back to about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So where are we in 2010? We've had Randy Wymore, of course, at the University in Oklahoma doing his work, but in my view, and I cast no disparaging remarks at Randy or anyone else, but Jan Smith is unique on the planet in her dedication and devotion to trying to find this issue out for what it is. I don't know if you know anyone who you would speak any differently of or more so than I have just spoken about Jan.
Well, absolutely not, Jeff, because Jan is not only is she doing great work and and attempting to bring her work to the public, but she's also dealing with this affliction and a very serious case of it. And to me, to be afflicted with this, people out there who are not familiar with it have got to realize that this stuff affects the way you live. It affects the way you interact with the world around you, and to be able to deal with this and overcome it and to put together the kinds of things that Jan has done is just absolutely fabulous.
It affects the way you think. Now, how do you do serious scientific research when your mind is being interfered with like this? And it does affect people differently, but one of the hallmarks of Morgellons is that it scrambles your emotions, your brains, your frame of reference, as a living being on the planet, and much more than that.
Well, yes, it does. But when it comes to having scrambled rationality, I think that Morgellons patients are not unique in that. I would probably classify the entire dermatological profession as having been afflicted with that.
Well said. I'll second and third that one for anybody else listening out there. The dermatology people have failed. That's kind. They have been an obscenity when it comes to dealing with this issue. DOP, delusions of... well, you tell us more about that, if you would, Cliff, and how these people call themselves doctors when they're diagnosing their patients as delusional, when in point of fact they're presenting 125% bona fide symptoms over and over again, which are absolutely identifiable and catalogable, and they continue to pretend like it's not there.
Which further strengthens my position that they're delusional, Jeff. The entire profession is delusional, and I think they seriously need to have some counseling, and hopefully we can provide that to them by educating them as to their shortcomings.
Well, having personally dealt with one very nice dermatologist who just absolutely didn't want to hear about it, they just don't. It's a very bizarre thing. So if you've got
Morgellons,
it's
a very bizarre thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's actually terrifying. It's a wake-up call for a lot of people. Many people who are afflicted with Morgellons at first go in to see these doctors, and they are not prepared for the treatment that they receive at the hands of these allegedly so-called professionals, and it creates, it's almost like falling out of the matrix.
Be devastating.
It's just unbelievable.
People. Yeah, true. Okay, Jan, how many years have you been actively involved in researching this bizarre, almost science fiction-like condition?
I really started researching it about 10 years ago, although I've had it longer. The first, 4 or 5 years, I was running around like the rest of the people, getting turned down from every place I went and being humiliated. So after a while, you don't get mad, you just get even. And I was really motivated because I always had pretty good credibility up until that point. And all of a sudden somebody, says, you're delusional and you don't have any credibility. Anything that you might have done in the rest of your life is negated. And
this was pretty hard to take. Jan is not exaggerating, ladies and gentlemen. And if any of you out there are dermatologists or know any, and you're not taking Morgellons seriously, you are shirking your professional and moral responsibilities as a healer. It's that simple. People actually, Jan and I, and we've talked years and years ago about this, but I want everybody to understand, when you went into a dermatologist's office and doctor's offices, and they would look at you and tell you there was something wrong with you mentally, not physically, they did it with a straight face. That's the part that's hard to believe.
The first person that I ever went to actually did it with delight because, of course, I hadn't read up on all of the old... there's a guy named Carl Axel Ekbom that coined this disease in the 1930s, and the big thing was you bring the sample in a matchbox, and if somebody's hauling something in a matchbox off of their body, they're nuts. So
right.
The first time I went to a dermatologist, I had a Ziploc bag with some stuff in it, and I mean, he smiled at me and he goes, let me show you this book. You're in here. And he pulled out this great big volume of stuff and he goes, this is what you have. And I just looked at him like, whoa, where am I?
Right. How many dermatologists did you and physicians did you eventually go to see before you decided to take this issue on as your own?
Probably about 10 of them.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, after a while I started bringing my husband with me. I needed somebody in the gallery for me to, beat him off with the club when they started in on that. I was coming home after these appointments very upset, and that's not my nature.
Right.
And I was trying to tell my husband the way I was being treated, and he really didn't quite believe me. So I started to bring him with me, and I got the opportunity to let him see that, and he was pretty shocked.
I imagine. It is truly unbelievable that a doctor would treat any patient like that. All right, we'll be right back with Cliff and Jan, and we have some very big news to share with you tonight, so stay tuned, and we'll continue after this. Okay, welcome back. Talking with Cliff Mickelson and Jan Smith. I don't know how many programs we've done on Morgellons now, but it's around 25 or more. This is something that is horrible. The government is guilty of the most abject abandonment of the public welfare and the insulting of countless individuals, which has led to some of their deaths. This is not a joking matter. It is a very, very serious illness. We're not going to spend a lot of time on the whys and wherefores and symptoms of it at this point. But Jan has come forward with some remarkable new information. If you look in the guests section at Rents.com, you'll see right under Morgellon's new developments, the paper of note tonight. There are two other papers below that put together by Jan. I would urge you to take a look at those as well. Jan, go ahead and tell us what it is you found, and I might suggest off the top that for those of you who know anything at all about Morgellons, you'll know that one of the most remarkable or odd manifestations of it is that the lesions, the open running sores on the body, rarely, if ever, become infected with secondary bacterial infestations, staph, strep, you name it. They just don't get infected. It's bizarre. That ties in somewhat with what Jan has come up with. Jan, please go ahead.
Well, I discovered this about 5 years ago, but unfortunately, in presenting it to different people that were actually in a position to research this, it didn't fly. It's called Dictyostelium discoideum, and we'll just call it cellular slime mold or slime mold from here. It's just easier to pronounce.
Slime mold, all right.
Slime mold. Mm-hmm. Something that usually is in the earth, and one of the things that I discovered about this slime mold is that it's a really, really big item for the government to mutate other cells and make other things out of stuff.
Okay, let's take that a little slower. The government likes this as a medium to do, I guess, genetic manipulation.
Yes, they do. It has
game
a very,
playing with yeah.
Yeah, it has a very low number of genes and chromosomes, so they can manipulate it considerably. And
like fruit flies, easy to play with.
Absolutely. And there's a whole website devoted to this called DictyBase, D-I-C-T-Y-B-A-S-E, and it's run by the NIH, some of my favorite people.
Oh, yeah.
So I had noticed that these manifestations on my skin looked an awful lot like some of the phases of this, but I only really ever found one phase of it, and that was on my own body. And at that point, I didn't really see enough to really make a determination what it really was, because it could have been a number of things, and I didn't want to really grasp for straws. And
was it within? Was it inside the parameters of a lesion that you're looking at?
Well, yeah, it was like the tentacles in the lesions. Remember, in the past, I had these pictures of like these. Like tentacles.
Yep.
And there's some. I don't know if everybody might be on the same page, but the page that you put up that says Dictyostelium found in Morgellon sufferers, there's some photos in there.
Yeah, that's the page we're talking about, otherwise known as slime mold. But you'll see a life cycle chart as well, and then
right.
Go on down below that, and you'll see other pictures. So feel free to point to those at any time.
Okay. it's quite an unusual type of, it's basically what it is it's slime mold, but it's actually individual amoeba that are protists. And they act as a single-celled organism, but when they go into the starvation mode, they give off these signals, and it's called, it's called TAMP or cyclic AMP, and it's, they have protein receptors on them, and when one of them signals, all the receptors and all the other ones all go, and it creates ions, and it creates an electrical charge. And when that happens, there's communication, which we've talked about before with the Morgellons.
Right.
It's like it seems we had mentioned before, if you touch one lesion, another lesion might do some kind of response to that, even if it was on another part of the body. And this whole action that they do with the protein, it can be done in a millisecond. And these spiral waves go out. It's almost like watching rings in the water spread.
Right.
And then they all start going into action, and they start going through this life cycle. And the reason they do this is they form this fruiting body that doesn't look anything like a single amoeba. They all form together. They have a substance in that makes them sort of stick together once they get into this mode. And they form this thing that I call like a Tootsie Pop on a stick. But basically there's a tube that runs through the center of a stalk, and it forms new amoeba. So when people say that there's something crawling under their skin, they're not kidding.
Well, the Jan's photo of tentacles, the Dictyostelium, you'll see what she's talking about here. This is not the classic fiber per se, which also exhibits movement, as we know now. So
right,
that's
just
another
one component.
Thing. Yeah, yeah. Is that fiber related to the Dictyostelium?
Some of the fibers are. And when I did the website, I had gone through hundreds of pictures that I had taken. And over the years, every time I had found something that I found interesting, I took a picture. And finally, when I did the website, I spent hours and hours going through all the pictures, and I discovered that there were many, many types of different fibers in our body, and I was able to categorize probably 10 of them as classifications that were actually different from one another in certain ways.
Right. Okay. Back in just a couple minutes with Cliff and Jan as we open the door and take a look in a new area of research that Jan actually pioneered several years ago, but we are finally able to bring it out here tonight, and hopefully it'll make sense to a lot of you out there who have Morgellons, know someone who has Morgellons. And I might add that there are a lot of you out there who may know more people with Morgellons than you think you do. And we'll leave it at that for the moment. Back in just a couple. Okay, and we're back. Cliff Mickelson and Jan Smith. Question, Cliff, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You were one of the first to mention, and the first to mention to me, that you felt as if somehow that this Morgellons affliction had almost a collective consciousness or unconsciousness or intelligence. Somehow that it was a condition that was rampant throughout the body, but that all of these disparate elements somehow had a means of, I won't say communicating, but I'll say communicating something.
I think communicating is a good word. It's sort of an intangible thing to try and describe, but I think a lot of Morgellon sufferers would attest to the fact that it's just, there's something going on that you just can't quite put your finger on. But whatever it is, it gives you an awareness that there is an awareness almost.
That you're not alone in your own body anymore.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, okay, Jan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, these are truly called social amoeba, and that's the reason that they really do communicate.
How do they communicate? Do we know?
Yeah, they communicate with these protein receptors. They all have protein receptors, and it's sort of like a chain reaction. It's like dominoes. When the first one says, we're hungry, we need to form this other shape because there's many different shapes in the cycle.
Right.
And like it's an immediate response from all of them. And it's like, you know, I think of the cartoons a kid used to watch called Wonder Twins. You know, Wonder Twins activate, and they all go into this other mode, and they start secreting this polymer that will make them all stick together and turn into like a whole whole other kind of a thing.
Are we suggesting that they have to be in physical proximity for this en masse communication to take place, or can they be spread out and separated by inches in the body?
Well, usually they probably don't separate by inches. Usually they mass together.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost like a liquid. As a matter of fact, if Morgellons people are familiar with, you know, pulling one of those crusts off of a lesion, they'll see this stuff ooze up out of the lesion and harden, and that's them.
That's the slime mold.
Yeah, that's the slime mold. I mean, it looks like a clear fluid,
mm-hmm.
and it'll harden up to a polymer.
Not a scab, ladies and gentlemen, like you're familiar with. It's a totally different thing. Do look at the pictures and understand that this has been called a science fiction ailment, illness, syndrome, because it is so bizarre and so unprecedented. Now, how would the dictyostelium prevent infection in a lesion?
Well, this brings it to mind one of your other guests that you've had on, and a person that's done a real lot of research is Clifford Carnicom, and he's mentioned in his travels that he sees a couple of different kinds of bacteria on the things that he's looking at.
Right.
And one of them, let me see if I can think of what they were. He has mycoplasma.
Mycoplasma is one.
Mycoplasma and chlamydial pneumonia.
Right.
And the thing about both of those is they're bacteria that are really tough to get rid of. One of them has no cell wall, so the traditional medicines can't do
much. That's the mycoplasma, right?
Right. And so basically the medicines that people do take for them just inhibit their multiplication. It doesn't outright kill them. And then the chlamydial pneumonia is an intracellular parasite, which means it has to go inside our cells,
mm-hmm.
and it feeds off of us to get its own reproduction.
Right.
So those are, you know, deep within our own cells. So those are a little harder to get at, too. So there needs to be kind of an extra amount of bacteria in our body, I think, beyond the stuff that's normally in our gut to support this. One of the people that I was talking to on the website was a lady that said she had actually had testing done on her body and found that she didn't have any beneficial bacteria at all left in her intestinal tract. But she
that's
had these
way,
other types
oh,
of...
hold on. That's usually about 5 to 6 pounds worth.
Yeah.
That's an extraordinary statement you just made.
Yeah.
Because the human digestive tract has pounds worth of friendly and, well, we need them. They're mandatory bacteria to
right.
help with the digestive process. And this person had virtually none left.
Right, but the doctors did find some of these other non-beneficial type bacteria in her body. So under normal circumstances, Dictyostelium would not live in a human being's body. There wouldn't be enough bacteria to keep it happy. So naturally, when they come up in a lesion, you're not going to get a secondary bacterial infection because that's going to be lunch.
All
for
right.
them.
So where else in the body might Dictyostelium be?
Well, I'm sure it's in all the hair follicles because the way it travels as amoeba forms, and, it, you know, Cliff will probably agree with me on this, we have what we call macrofibers, and we know that something's living in the hair follicle. It's
right.
mutating the hairs, and it's growing up on the outside of them and coating them with slime. And rather than if it was some other kind of a liquid, it wouldn't necessarily crawl up the hair and coat it with something. It might be on the skin around the hair follicle, but actually it's usually on the hair. And it's pretty well bonded together on the hair.
Right. Now, the woman, I've forgotten how many years ago it was now, but a long time ago, we had a woman on from Australia who talked about
right.
her hair follicles had been taken over, and the hairs themselves were no longer hairs, but they were something else. Now, I'm not sure if she was accurate with that, or if she was perhaps describing hairs that were covered with this particular slime mold.
No, I think she's absolutely on the money. As a matter of fact, if people get a chance sometime to go to my website, I have a section in my photo journal, and it's all pictures, so it's easy going, but it's called Bad Hair Day. And
yeah.
I've got a picture, numbers of pictures, and what I've pointed out in these pictures is almost all of the hairs that I found and put in these pictures all had blue fibers growing from the inside of the bulb of the hair.
Inside of the bulb, is the hair itself gone completely, or has it sort of been taken over?
There's something that looks something like a hair still there.
Uh-huh.
Usually the core of the hair is gone, but down in that very bulb that comes out of the follicle,
right.
There's fibers growing in it. And sometimes it's hollow, sometimes it's black, sometimes
wow.
it's enlarged and misshapen.
Well, I remember this woman describing this on the program, and she said that literally all around her forehead, the hair follicles had been taken over by Morgellons, and they moved and kept her awake all night. She couldn't sleep because they were moving, ever so slightly, but just enough for her to feel them.
Oh, yeah, they would move because that's what amoeba do.
Yeah. This is just amazing. Every time we do this, it never ceases to just boggle my mind. We'll be right back with Cliff and Jan in just a few. Okay, and we're back talking Morgellons with Cliff and Jan. Cliff, what about this hair issue in your experience? How many people, how often is it is it commonly described?
I believe it's universal, Jeff, and that people that aren't aware of it or don't believe that it is just haven't looked in the right places. Jan's absolutely correct in stating that these things do appear, the extrusions and the fibers do appear in the hair follicles, if indeed we'll call them hair follicles. They are definitely a captive hair follicle, if that's what they are.
Huh.
We call them diseased hairs, macrophibers, but
mm-hmm.
There's no question that these things are found at the root and in the base of them.
Do the hairs still grow to any length of substantial note,
yes.
or do they stay short?
Well, actually, they do continue to grow, albeit at a somewhat slower pace. The interesting thing about them is that when they're removed, there seems to be very little, if any, pain. It's almost as if the actual nerve endings are either gone or non-existent, completely numbed.
Wow. All right. Those of you who just joined us, please go to Jan's paper. It's right directly there in the guest section under her name. You'll see it.
Yeah.
And look at the
Jeff,
pictures.
Let me add one thing to that. I'd
please,
like to say that these
Cliff.
particular hairs, if you will, are almost always swollen. They're engorged, and then they are coated on the outside with basically what you could call a slime.
The hair shaft itself is engorged.
Engorged.
It's
yes,
bigger
it is.
Than the normal hair in diameter.
Much bigger. Much bigger.
Pretty freaky stuff.
Very.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Jan. Back to the slime mold discovery, which again happened several years ago, but nobody would listen.
True. But the thing that really made it good for me was that when I first got the website up, I asked people to send me pictures. And although I had studied the various phases of this, I hadn't seen them in myself. And, you know, at that point, I had just seen the ones that looked like the tentacles. And these two ladies both sent me pictures. One, you know, one was from the West Coast and one was from Texas. And I took a look at those and I went, oh, my God, you know, I recognize this stuff. So I went back to my pals at the Dixie Base, and I took their pictures. And on the page, you can see on the left-hand side is of the first picture is a sample from a Morgellons person in Texas, and then
right.
on the right-hand side is the aggregation of the dictyostelium. This is when those waves go out, and they start making these circular patterns, and this is when they're communicating. And I saw that in hers, and I was really shocked. And also, there's another thing that defines this in between certain clusters of cells, they must have theirs on a darker base, or either that, or they don't have all the ooze, but it makes little sections in between.
Mm-hmm.
These things can sense how many cells are in a cluster, because each cluster is ultimately going to turn into a slug. So all of the cells from the outside of each cluster are going to go toward the middle, and it's going to turn into a sluggy-looking, slimy thing. And I know many Morgellons people have seen these slugs. on their bodies, and they don't, you know, they've known that they were something, and they might have called them flukes or other things, but
right.
Let me
try and pull back for a bigger picture here.
Sure.
We've got fibers, we've got slime, we've got slugs, we've got hair follicles, we've got all kinds of different things.
Right.
All part of the same syndrome, or does one syndrome invite another? Are there two different or three different things at work here, or is this one big family of insanity?
Well, as a matter of fact, I think there's something else going on with Addictio Stellium. In my opinion, there's something else that's already mutated in with it, because the amoeba cells that are in the Addictio Stellium that I find have extra components than the ones that they mention, and the ones that I have antennas on them. Every one of them.
Okay, now let's describe that a little bit more. Do we have a picture of that up there?
We
have tentacles. I'm not sure if we have the antenna picture up there.
No, I don't. I don't think we do. And what I can say is that in my original videos that I have on my website,
mm-hmm.
And some of the pictures that I have in my Living with a Nightmare story, I point those out, and I have number of pictures where I show each one of the amoeba,
right.
And each one has a foot, and each one always has an antenna. And the antenna are very odd looking.
Okay.
And I don't think those are part of the original amoeba at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
I think these are already in a stage of mutation. In fact, the ladies that sent me the pictures of the Addictio Stellium were in the early phases when the disease was really virulent in their bodies, and other than that, them being able to do that, I don't think we would have captured this.
Yeah, Jeff, I would add to that that the mutation, or actually progression, if you will, seems to be a real common occurrence with Morgellon sufferers, and they can actually trace the changes that take place in with the affliction in their body as they move through time. But also, I might suggest that there's a possibility that we're dealing with Addictio Stellium that's, or a form thereof that's been genetically played with, and there, we're not just dealing with a straight Addictio Stellium, we're dealing with a hybrid of some kind that's been manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Well, they certainly have the science to do anything they want now. Go ahead,
yeah,
Jen.
My guess is they have mixed. Now when I say guess, I feel really solid on the Addictio Stellium, but I have also found samples of all my CDs over the course of time, and I feel like that is part of what's going on with this. I feel that pretty strongly, and one of the reasons that I do is some of the tentacles that I found, found a number of them, they have various different things inside of them. Normally, if it was Addictio Stellium, it would just make a stalk inside of it and grow little cells, but the stuff that I find, you know, sometimes I find a rays inside of them, and sometimes blue inky stuff, and sometimes black fibers. So I believe that, you know, here's where some nanotechnology may be poking into some biotechnology.
You're talking about something pretty sophisticated and not
yeah,
very
elemental.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm talking about something that I didn't even think that we had technology for, but
right.
Then again, you know, going back to your new website called Sightings, we don't always know where all of those things come from. They may come
no.
from the government, but it might be a secondhand move from somewhere else. I don't want to get too far out on the wavelength because people already want to say we're delusional, but, you know, I don't want to discount anything either.
Well, anybody who discounts anything is really missing the boat now, because everything is possible. And then some. We just can't be so arrogant to discount anything like that. This idea of antennas and DNA or genetic manipulation and mutation, the idea of an antenna itself suggests either a transmission or a reception, or both. What are your feelings about that?
Oh, well, after we get done through with the Addictio Stellium, we can go down to the...
All right, let's revisit that later then. Fine.
Yeah.
Okay, this is all going somewhere, and I want you to all pay close attention to it. Please read Jan's papers. Living with a Nightmare is on the left-hand side of Rents.com. In the Morgellons featured story section, you'll find it there. The imagery there is again evocative of the antenna issue we're describing here. Okay, now this Morgellons Texas lady, Addictio Stellium, is that's a pretty frighteningly ugly. It looks like a nightmare of a a pepperoni pizza or something.
Yeah,
it's,
and
it's not a pretty picture.
Little swirls in it, and that's because it's in that aggregation phase where it's signaling.
Got it. Okay, now,
and right after that happens, it goes right into this next phase of the next picture, where it starts cordoning itself off into these little sections.
Well, it's like a matrix.
It does. It cordons itself off into these little sections, and instead of being individuals, they start forming little lines, and then those lines all converge into that center where you see a solid color, and all of a sudden you've got clumps.
Is that common for Dictyostelium to do that?
Yeah, that's what it does. It does that anytime it feels it's threatened by not getting enough bacteria, enough food. And on the website, I was fortunate enough to just find a video that shows the whole phase, and you can see it all in motion. So if anyone wants to see that later, I've put that on my website under the my throwback papers.
All right, so this is pretty wild.
I mean, I just feel like it was so fortuitous that these two women should send me these because, I've been looking for more proof before I wanted to go out there with this because, it's too easy to refute one thing, but this is the only organism that makes these types of configurations.
Does this organism exist in human beings who do not have Morgellons?
No, it doesn't usually exist in human beings.
At all?
I guess it can on some occasions. I tried to look that up.
But it's transient, is what you're saying. It's
pretty rare. I mean, most of the time, there's the amoebas that people have are like acanthamoebas and different things like that.
Right.
But this isn't like a well-known disease that people get because we really don't have enough bacteria to support it in the normal circumstance.
So this is a bacteria-consuming organism. That's what it eats.
Yeah, that's all it eats.
Would someone have, in a laboratory, tried to introduce this into a sick person with a bad bacterial infection to see if this amoeba could somehow rid the body of that? Is that something that some crazy scientist would try to do? Hopefully with lab animals first?
I don't know.
I mean, if they eat bacteria, that's kind of more efficient than antibiotics in some ways, if the organism would do its job and then either be removable or just die off.
Well, actually, if I could jump in, Jeff, I'd say there's also one other possibility that we haven't looked at, and that is that some agrobacterial agriculture company may have developed something that they thought could eat harmful bacteria.
That's what I'm suggesting, ultimately.
Bag.
Yeah, rather than a spray, perhaps, or something.
Absolutely, because that's been a very unregulated area.
Okay, all right, well, there's another door open. We'll be back in a few minutes with Jan Smith and Cliff Nicholson as we do our latest Morgellons program up to date and bring you the very latest from Jan in her paper, which is up there. All of Jan's papers, all of her materials at her website are well worth reading. They are frightening and highly informative at the same time. Be right back with more after this. Okay, welcome back. Hour number two, Cliff Nicholson and Jan Smith, my special guests. We're doing our latest Morgellons update special. Jan's paper on Dictyostelium, otherwise known as slime mold, an amoebic form found in many Morgellons patients. How many have you found Dictyostelium in, and how common do you think it is?
All I can say is that I've seen a number of people's pictures that anybody that has the hooked scabs, the tentacle-type scabs, that's an indication. So I think it depends on the person. Now, everybody that I know probably has a pretty bad case of it. Most of the people that I talk to a lot are pretty badly hit with this. Some people are not so much, though, and there may be times when people have had the indications of it. And one of the things that I did want to say while I was on tonight was that what I find in the retrospect is a lot of people that had a really bad breakout of this in the beginning a lot of them have cleared up considerably. So there's only a few people that kind of go around all the time with a pack of lesions that have for years and years and years. So, you know, I was thinking in terms of some of these people with their snake oil medicine that, you know, if you go to somebody long enough, your body may mutate its way out of the really worst of it as far as the skin manifestation.
Yes,
it still
thank
might
you.
Feel lousy.
Right, absolutely. A wonderful point. Well taken. Be careful of people selling cures for Morgellons. Cliff, we've been through this many, many times. There are no cures for Morgellons.
That's absolutely right, Jeff. And I'd like to take this opportunity to mention also to a lot of people out there who have put their faith in Nutrisilver and other kinds of things similar to that, that colloidal silver has some very useful purposes. It's very useful for a lot of things. It does not affect Morgellons at all.
So
it will not cure Morgellons.
Yeah, there's a bit. Actually, the FDA has declared war against colloidal silver products of all kinds. So, and it's because of claims like this, although the government doesn't officially recognize Morgellons, but that these witch hunts become easier for the government to perpetrate. So it's
right,
tough.
That's true. And, you know, I use sea silver myself, but I don't use it for Morgellons. It's a wonderful, wonderful antibiotic for certain things.
Exactly.
It has a wonderful bunch of purposes, but Morgellons, folks, is not one of them.
Right.
I don't know if you remember way back when, but I did a show with you once, and I actually had a really big lesion, and I had taped a silver dollar on it, and I wound up getting particles. I had wrapped it in one layer of gauze and soaked it in colloidal silver and applied it to the lesion and left it overnight. And the next day, I found all of these actual crystals, you know, square red crystals from this red glowing gel stuff stuck to the coin. And then I did a burn experiment on it, and they blew up like little balloons, but they didn't burn. So one of the things that I think about silver especially is if it's too large of a silver, if you have those, you know, parts of you inside of you is that red gel, and
right.
You turn that into crystalloid parts, how's that going to pass out of your body?
Exactly.
And during the course of time when this was all going on, there were a number of people saying that they had kidney stones right after doing the silver. So, you know, really beware, because I think in some instances it could be harmful, depending on, you know, what your body's doing with the Morgellons at the time.
So just keep in mind that the Morgellon symptoms can cycle in people, all right? And if you're doing a particular protocol and your body happens to cycle into a different stage or phase of Morgellons in terms of physical manifestations, it doesn't necessarily mean that what you're taking had anything whatsoever to do with that. You've got to keep that in mind, too. We're not exactly doing double-blind work here, so be careful, very careful.
That's absolutely correct, Jeff. And probably the best advice that anybody could follow at this point is just try and build your immune system and keep yourself healthy and get as much rest as you can. But that immune system is all important. Keep it strong.
And you can't have a good immune system by eating meat, dairy, processed foods, pizza, cheese, and all the rest of the crap, the great American diet. It doesn't work. You're poisoning yourself continually and beating your immune system half to death before it has a chance to do anything much. And then if you're an angry person, 1 minute of anger can compromise your immune system for 6 to 8 hours. That's another fact. So there's a lot to this, and attitude, lifestyle, immune function, and good diet are crucial in keeping somebody motile and reasonably healthy in the face of all this. Okay, Jan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was going to add, about a year ago, I got diabetes, which wasn't great, but it was good in one aspect, in that when I cut all of that sugar out of my life, and just the carbohydrates, you know, themselves, even from, you know, things like potatoes and flour or anything white like that, the amount of lesions went down considerably. So I have another friend up here in New Hampshire who didn't really have any weight problems or any diabetes problems, but he decided he was going to go carbohydrate-free to see how that would work for him, to see if he could get any kind of a result. And
he had more gallons. He had more gallons.
Yeah, he had more gallons, and he got a huge result. He had a number of lesions on his neck for years and years and years that were really prominent. They almost looked like giant scars or something, and they went right down. And he was guilty of being a high consumer of fructose, corn syrup, because he was doing the soda pop thing. And he feels so much better now, even though he still has it. The symptoms are so much better. And he says that he has tried to add back in, you know, carbohydrates from time to time, and as soon as he does, he starts to not feel good, and he immediately can tell the difference. So, you know, it's anecdotal, but still, it's worth a shot.
No, it's important. You bet it is. HFCS is a killer. All those corn syrup products are just, over time, will destroy your body. That's interesting. I wonder if there's anything in the literature about this the slime mold and exposing it to sugar, starches, carbohydrates, and other things like that. I wonder if anybody's done any research on that. Might be interesting to find out, because they're suggestive of a link there somehow with lesions
and
diet.
Well, you know, if you eat sugar products, that you get a lot of bacteria in your mouth, just on your teeth.
Yep.
So, you know, it may kind of work that way throughout.
Well, cancer loves sugar also. So.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Okay, now, let's go to this idea of full body penetration and dictyostelium. Is it an epidural situation? What is it? Do we think it's everywhere?
Well, I think it depends on where people have sort of manifestations of it. I know my friend had a big manifestation on his neck. I don't so much. I more have had things on my hands and arms. It might be a variation on different people. And I'm not sure why. I have some hairs on my body that probably aren't very affected by this, and then I have other places where it's very much more affected.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a strange thing. If you had to break this syndrome down into primary components, how would you do it, Jan?
You mean for the whole disease?
Yeah, the whole disorder, the whole affliction, the whole syndrome. How would you do it? We got fibers. We have many kinds of fibers,
and I mean, we have two kinds of fibers. I mean, in one category, we have fibers that burn and fibers that don't. The fibers that burn may be of more of a bioorganic nature, and the ones that don't are obviously some kind of polymers that aren't supposed to be in people. I go back to some of the nanotests that were done in actual labs in the past, they seem very valid to me. But that wasn't the whole picture. I think that this is a really multi-part disease, and there's some synergy involved with these multiple parts. I don't know what the ultimate goal of it is, but it looks like a system to me, and it seems sort of calculated that whatever we're getting in us all interacts with each other for a purpose.
Some of it might be along for the ride, too. Some of it could be symbiotically parasitic with the primary modality of whatever Morgellons is. We don't know.
Now, in the beginning, people were saying they had Calimbula, and one of the things that Calimbula might really go for is anything made out of cellulose, and dictyostelium, when it gets into that fruiting thing, is 55% cellulose, and that's on the outside. So at some point, that outside part decomposes. So you've got decomposing cellulose on a human body, and I guess Calimbula, that's their favorite thing to eat.
What is Calimbula?
That is a really tiny insect life thing that lives on almost all plants, almost like a plant lice kind of a thing. So that's what that was thought to be, and people had found pictures of that in there, and that wouldn't be unusual, because basically the smell of rotting cellulose would be an attraction to them, and especially in the original Texas, California, Florida batch of people, they would be living in, you know, a warmer climate, and probably have, you know, year-round insects, whereas I live in New England, and we don't have that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Stand by, back in just a minute with Cliff and Jan. And if you folks have subscriptions, go back and listen to March 1st, hour number 2 with Dr. Ed Spencer, MD. Ed was on. Thanks, Jan, for helping set that up as well.
Oh, sure.
He's quite a man, and we talked about Morgellons in that hour as well. Okay, be right back, gang. Stay there. Okay, let's get right back to our conversation with Cliff Nicholson and Jan Smith. All right, Jan, your paper is up there. And anything else you want to mention about that? There's a lot to talk about here. This Dictio Stellium phases is fascinating to look at.
I think it's the base component for many of the other things that are going on.
Hmm.
I don't know if we'll have time tonight, but a really dear friend of mine made a great find. I know that people have always questioned where, you know, Morgellons fiber balls come from. Well, a lot of times single fibers will come out, but she actually found something in her body, and other people have found them since then, and she's called them pods. And they're actually something that's very similar to an amoeba, except that on the inside, it has all of these fibers growing in it, in kind of a little womb of, made out of Dictio Stellium.
Hmm. Well, all right. When people are listening to us talk tonight, some are probably saying, what are they talking about, nano device? You can't see nanotechnology. It's too small. But you can see the end result of it.
Right.
That's the point. And that's what we're potentially looking at here. There's one you call a nanocommunications array at 60 power. It's a brown mass with a light-colored, glass-colored, looks like almost translucent polymer-like fiber curled around it and apparently through it.
That was actually living inside of one of those tentacles, and the way that this occurred was when I found this, I had to put it under a slide to actually get the little beads of, they're actually little faceted pieces of some kind of a silver metallic substance in here, and then they have a black carbon black framing around each one of them, but they're so symmetrical, and they line up just like the picture on the right-hand side of this, and I knew that when I found this, the way it had to have been formed is it had to have been folded like an umbrella within that tentacle, and so that is just one of the many things that has been growing in the Dictio Stellium base.
Wow, and again, to go back to the beginning, we do know that the government likes to play with this particular organism for a variety of reasons.
Oh, they do.
All right. Cliff?
Yes.
Anything else to add here?
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting to me that one of the experiments that Jan and I have discussed in the past and that I actually performed on myself was that I applied a sulfur compound known as calcium polysulfate to some of the exterior lesions that I was suffering from, and the results were instantaneous, and that is a strong agricultural poison that's designed to kill molds, fungus, and things like that. So that was, it's kind of anecdotal, but it's kind of an interesting aside.
Right. Okay. All right, well, we know what is happening in the world of Monsanto and GMO crops, and what we know is what we hear about, what they're experimenting on behind closed doors, God only knows. Okay, now we're going to move into an area that's very interesting, and this is relatively new. It has to do with frequencies. Tell us about that, if you would, Jan, please.
Oh, okay. This all started a long time ago, and I give credit to one of the chat boards that I was on, but people were using amp meters, or voltage meters for cars, and they were testing themselves with these things.
We are electrical first, folks. Remember that always. Electrical first, chemical second.
So they were getting a reading, and my friend that lives up here in New Hampshire that has more gallons, I related that to him, and he's like, oh, that can't be, because he's an electronic engineer, and he's really into all of these kinds of things. And so he kind of doubted me, and he happens to own three oscilloscopes, so he had... He was up there, and then he had another friend that has more gallons at his house. So they decided to try the oscilloscopes out and see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they each tried a number of them just to make sure there was a baseline on all of them, and they got quite a reading. Being kind of an expert in the field, determined that these were pretty much satellite frequencies, because I had spoken to him earlier, and I said, well, you know, what about Rife machines? And he said, the way these frequencies look, I don't think a Rife machine could go that high.
What are we talking about, up to 100,000?
Yeah.
Hertz? And above?
Yeah.
Must be way up there.
Yeah. I mean, he just said it was, you know, readings on these things were really astronomical. I mean,
and they were coming off the bodies of the people being tested.
Yeah, just by holding the leads of these machines in their hands.
And he was quite shocked.
Yeah, well, he was way shocked because one of the readings was his.
Uh-huh. Do we have a test group control that is not
infected? Did. Yeah, he did try it with somebody with no symptoms or anything, and they actually did get a flat line.
Wow.
I mean, normally people don't register on these.
Not at that level, no.
So, you know, here's the sad part. I mean, we know this works, but there's no organization to actually put this into practice and take it somewhere. The saddest thing about this whole community is I can find any number of things, but, you know, it's great to talk to the public about them, but unless we can get the medical community to do something about it, the medications even that we would need for an amoeba infection are very specialized. They're not even something that you could get without, a special visit to somebody and a prescription, even if those would work. It's the same thing with things like these. What would we do with the results, and who would follow through for us on it? This is where we're so lacking.
We're going to take a break here in just a minute, and when we come back, we'll ask Cliff to comment about the general state of the Morgellons community, which is fragmented. There are egos vying and suggestions of certainly government influence and penetration here and there. It's not a good situation. That's why the work of Jan and Cliff and some others is so critically important. And when you have a community of people who are essentially desperate and frightened and scared and apprehensive and anxiety-ridden, it's pretty easy to keep them split apart. Be right back with more. Okay, back with Jan and Cliff. The politics of Morgellons, Cliff. It's never been a pretty picture. How would you characterize it now?
I would characterize it as being pretty consistently dismal. We've run into the same roadblocks over and over again, and of course we've had a number of Pied Pipers appear and disappear, if you will, over the course of the last 10 years, who have done their best to lead the community in different directions and create fragmentation. Very, very suspicious in origin, all of it. And of course, I think our main focus at this point, the people that are really working hard, is to build a community awareness and just to keep on building that community awareness, which is one of the reasons that we have the Morgellons Conference every year in Austin. We're having it this month, as a matter of fact, at the end of the month. And that's to basically let people know that, hey, we're still here, we're not going away, and we're not going to allow ourselves to be marginalized.
What happened to the fabled CDC investigation?
Yes. Well, into the mystic with that one.
Yeah. Gone in the ethers. Cliff wrote a paper on
smoke.
As soon as they announced this, Cliff was all over it, as were many in the community who understood that the CDC and the AMA and the dermatological organizations were all obviously aware of what was going on here, that something was very seriously wrong, but they would have nothing to do with it. The lid came down, and this bogus Kaiser Permanente evaluation, $300,000+, which is pocket change, as you know, was supposed to have results a year ago last December, wasn't it?
A year ago last December, that's correct.
Yeah, so we're still waiting, folks, and no one's holding their breath, at least I hope not.
Absolutely, and at the time, you know, I the reason that this whole thing came about on the part of the CDC and Kaiser was because they were getting some heat, because there had been enough squeaky wheels out there that they were actually getting some heat from some folks in Congress and from the general public. So one of the ways that you can kill something like that when you can't ignore it is you just underfund it and get rid of it that way.
All right, we're launching a study. We're funding it. Of course, it's pocket change again. And some of the squeaky wheels, of course, ladies and gentlemen, are right here on the program with me tonight, Cliff and Jan. And we raised a lot of noise back then, and I think that may well be exactly why this bogus research was undertaken, if it was ever undertaken at all. We don't know.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Jan.
On September 24th, 2009, they convened an external panel to examine the study activities to date and provide advice on future activities. DPD outlined several questions for the panel to address. So basically, the CDC has handed it over to whoever the DPD is, Center for Zoonotic Vector-Borne Enteric Diseases. And one of the questions on here, which I really... this is one of the questions they can do with what the study already says is, what findings can be communicated to the public, the medical community, and the stakeholder community? So they're asking, you know, what can we tell people? You know, it's like, how much do we have to hide? Or, you know, that's kind of a nutty question to be on something.
Sure is, yeah.
So that's where we leave it with that. And I did visit their website yesterday just to see if there were any updates at all. And the update on that was, go see your own physician, and if you don't have one, click here to find one. So they have
really?
A thing that's called Physician Finder, and you go there, and it's a generic physician thing. It says it's for the AMA, and X number of people belong to it, and you can type in your zip code all day long, and nothing comes up. So that's what they're doing for us now.
So there you are, right back to square one, and they managed to do a complete chase your tail with and waste 2.5 years of everybody's time.
Sure
and so
did.
my position on this whole thing is it's time to really get squeaky.
What is the status of getting, this is a little dark side, but getting a real, at least one or two autopsies done on people who have passed on who have had Morgellons? We still, to my knowledge, don't have one, do we?
No, and you know, somebody recently passed away on one of the Morgellon spores, and it's kind of hearsay, but I found that this woman did leave her body to science, and at some point they couldn't find it.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
The lid is down on this, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a joke. They don't want this gone into. They don't want internal organs to be found full of these various types of Morgellons artifacts. They do not want that. They don't want people's brains to be looked at because for fear of what they may find. And Jan can tell you she's had two knees replaced, and what they found in the middle of her knees was not supposed to be there.
No.
At all. Did you ever have any further ramifications from those two operations and surgeries that were done by competent people who were obviously quite surprised? As I remember you telling us, the second surgery was done in full, well, not hazmat, but like moon suits.
Yeah, yeah. And we speak of Ed Spencer again, only because Ed Spencer called my doctor for me and said, you better take this seriously, and thank God for Ed.
That's
or I would
funny.
Have been in a room with, you know, three teenage kids and all their boyfriends like I was when I had my back surgery.
Is that true?
Yeah, I had back surgery. That was the most recent thing, and I had disc surgery on two discs. And and even though I had been there before with the knee surgery about a couple of years earlier, and a half, when I went in for the back surgery, all the bets were off as far as anything Morgellons related. The one thing that they did do was take some pathology slides, and I actually have some nerve tissue out of my vertebrae from the ruptured disc.
Yeah.
And they have fibers growing in them. And the funny part about that was I've never had a lesion on my back at all or any part of my spine.
Okay, so you were able to get from the medical
right.
people.
Right. Fortunately...
You didn't say anything about anything, and you just said, can I have some of this? And
no, actually, I was working with another doctor then, and she called the hospital and
requested.
You know, and got the slides. And in the meanwhile, I really wasn't working with her anymore, and she hadn't done anything with them for over a year, so I asked for them back. So when I got them back, I broke the seal on it. They hadn't been looked at. And I was looking at my own nerve tissue and looking at the fibers growing in them, and I thought, well, I've got these 12 slides made by the Concord Hospital. What do I do with them?
Wow. So nerve tissue in the spine had fibers.
Were right. Absolutely.
What did the fibers look like after that period of time? I hate to even ask you, but did they look viable?
Yeah, they always look viable for some reason. And even the amoeba tissue, even when you pull that off as a crust and you put it in fluid, that gets viable again, too.
This is not good.
No, I mean, this stuff is like built to last, I think.
And built to penetrate everywhere.
Yeah.
All right, one more segment to go in our latest Morgellons update with Jan Smith and Cliff Mickelson. We'll rejoin you in just a couple minutes. Do avail yourself of Jan's research. It's on the guest section side of the homepage. It's also on the left-hand side. Go down and look for Morgellons, and there's a lot of material there. So if you think you have it, do your research. Be right back. And continuing with Cliff and Jan. Cliff, any public education programs of note at all being offered to the general populace about this issue now from the feds?
No, none whatsoever that I'm aware of. The only programs out there are being offered by several of the foundations that are involved directly in Morgellons, the Charles Holman Foundation and the Morgellons Foundation.
Right. All right, Jan, what do you want to do next? Where do you want to go with this?
Well, I was just thinking, I just put out a new article, and you have the link to it, and I just wanted to discuss this. This is another... this was a hidden webpage that was found by a friend of mine with Morgellons. It seems that her family has a rare chromosome, which is called a trisomy, which means that there's an extra gene in their chromosomes. This is a family that has several Morgellons people, and the chromosome normally gives you a disease called situ inversus, which means all of your organs are on the other side of your body. It's really rare. And just as on a fluke, she thought, well, why don't I type the number of the chromosome in and write in the word Morgellons? When you're Googling, it doesn't cost anything, and you just think, well, I'll give it a shot.
So was it a hunch, or was it something else? Who knows?
People had been talking before about this disease being somewhat genetically related. It seems like everyone I know has some kind of European ancestry, a lot of people from Scandinavian countries. A lot of people with either blue or green eyes, a real preponderance of that from what I gather. So we thought, well, maybe chromosomes are involved. So she typed this in, and she pulled up a page from the Office of Rare Diseases, and on this page about the chromosomes, there's a note on the bottom that says, to learn more about suspected cases of Morgellons information, call the voicemail line this number. So she's like, what the heck is this? So she got excited. She thought, wow. There's something in place for us, and wow, how did they know this disease that this genetic thing they have is so rare. I mean, it's like obscure. And so she called the phone line, and obviously whoever the operator was on that line probably had that job for quite a while. This thing had been on the internet for over a year because it had a date on it when it had last been worked on, and so when she called up and she said she was a Morgellons person, she immediately got the answer. This is a mistake. This is just a clerical error, and I found that real hard to believe, because at the same time people were calling the CDC and the NIH to try to find out what Morgellons people should do when we were getting the blow off big time, and they were saying, we're not a medical place, so go find a doctor, and we can't help you. So in the meanwhile, they're running this paper with Morgellons information on it, so you wouldn't even think they'd have the word Morgellons in their database at that time.
Not.
This was done in 2007, or 2006. It was on there. 2007, she found them, and
who
they
was
didn't
funding
even acknowledge it?
It. Who was funding this?
This is the Office of Rare Diseases, NIH.
It was NIH, okay.
The National Institute of Health.
Yeah.
So this is their letterhead and the whole deal. So they looked into it, and They got excited, but they knew something was wrong, because 3 days later, every single copy of this was pulled off the internet, and all the cash copies were gone. And,
They scrubbed the cash, too. Wow.
Yeah, the cash, too, and I think that's a trick. And they had given this story to one other website, and they asked them to take it off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd be happy to put it up if somebody has a copy of it.
Well, the only thing that we wound up with was a snapshot of a partial piece of the page, and I do have it on the website, but I find it very interesting. I'd be glad to give it to you.
Well, if you can tie some text to it, we'll run it. I mean, it's probably been scrubbed from the Wayback Machine, too. That's usually a repository of everything that's been on the Internet, but if these people have the cloud, and obviously they do, they can go back and delete anything.
Well, the question that we would have with that is, you know, if it has something to do with chromosomes, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody doesn't have this, but it may mean that not having this duplication or the trisomy of a chromosome may have something to do with the way this manifests in some people. In her family, it's a really severe manifestation.
Mm-hmm. Well, bizarre. All right, Mr. Mickelson, 2010. We've really gotten nowhere except through the hard work of you and Jan and some others. The sharks, snakes, frauds, and charlatans, quacks notwithstanding. It's been a citizen scientist effort. Clifford Carnicom is hard at work. There are a few heroes out there doing what the government should be doing and probably knows about, but they're not going to tell us. So where do we go from here, my friend?
I believe, Jeff, at this point in time, that we need to make a public. We need to continue to educate the public, and we need to continue to make enough noise to where we cannot be ignored, we cannot be marginalized, and that means that we have to overcome the stupor that was induced upon the entire Morgellons community by the CDC fraud. And we need to get angry. We need to move forward, and we need to make our case.
Do we have? We have a couple celebrities now who are acknowledged to be Morgellons victims. Who are they, Jan?
One of them was is his name Billy Cook or Koch, K-O-C-H? He was a baseball player, and I think at this point he's kind of, you know, he was, you know.
Well, that goes back years ago. He was a top pitcher in baseball.
And then there's I can't think of her name. There's a singer that's a kind of
Barbara Mandrell, I think.
Well, there's another one.
Oh, Louise Mandrell that is working with the Morgellons.org, and her husband has this. But
Joni Mitchell, I think, or not Carly Simon, but I think you're right. One or the other has it. Until and unless we get more celebrities with this, I hate to say it, but we are in a celebrity culture. We're probably not going to get too much of an entree into the mainstream media. If you get into People magazine, that's kind of like getting into Time magazine now because it has a bigger readership. Is that weird?
Yeah. That's true, though.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the sad things is I am in touch with a group of people that are trying to, you know, get funds together and try to find somebody that's philanthropic enough to, you know, fund some lab work. And apparently it's very hard to get anyone to go near any kind of Morgellons lab work with a 10-foot pole at this point as well. So, you know, everywhere we go, there's a brick wall.
Yeah.
And at this point, I mean, we need a philanthropist to come and fund something.
Well, we need a philanthropist to actually build a laboratory, too, because you're probably not going to get into one. I mean, that's seriously how bad it is. It is Joni Mitchell, by the way, who has Morgellons.
Yeah.
And probably others who don't want to talk about it because it's not something you want to wear on your sleeve and broadcast. It just isn't. How widespread is it now, Cliff? Do you have evidence or suggestive material and data that it's growing and any kind of is it exponential? Is it growing at a relatively slow pace? Do we have any idea at all? It does grow erratically. It doesn't go necessarily in a perfect person-to-person chain. It's like broken glass, the way it seems to spread.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And it is continuing to grow at an astounding rate. Cases are always popping up, new cases. All the boards, there's always new faces on the boards, which tell you that there's new cases that are out there appearing every day. People are becoming more and more aware that they have this. And, you know, it's just, it's all over the place. It's on all the continents of the planet, and it's just going everywhere.
Jan?
Yeah, I agree, and I think of a friend of mine that lives in Florida that knows a number of elderly people, and as she's been more cognizant of the disease, she's looked around and she's, you know, noticed on a lot of older people that they have Morgellons, but it's usually, you know, it's not always all over their body. Sometimes it's near their wrist, sometimes it's on the calves of their leg, and you know, she's even, you know, had the veracity to say, you know, to be forward enough to say to them, you know, gee, what do you have? And they just go, gee, I don't know. I just hit something weird, and it's itchy, but it, I've had it for, like, so many years, and it doesn't go away. And, the dermatologist said, I got dermatitis, and she knows what it is.
Contact dermatitis, right?
Yeah. So some people do seem to maintain, like, a bunch of it, like, in one spot, and when they do, they don't really think twice about it.
Yeah.
I mean, if it stays like that, then they don't have that alarm about the whole thing.
Right. All right. Somebody's got lesions. Somebody has symptoms. Somebody's done their own research on the Internet. What is your best counsel for them, Cliff? Where to go? First of all, probably not to a doctor. Probably not to a dermatologist unless they've got very thick skin.
Absolutely. I personally would avoid that whole route altogether. You're just wasting your time, wasting your money. There are a few doctors out there who are hip to this situation and are willing to treat people best as they can. Those people can be contacted through the Charles Holman Foundation and through the Morg Ellens Foundation. But other than that, yeah, don't go to the doctor. It's just you're not getting anywhere with that. Need to take care of yourself and take care of your immune system. Eat well, sleep well. And go from there, and then contact some of the established foundations and follow some of the protocols that are advised on there.
What's the latest, Jan, on depression and personality changes with this? Are we still seeing the same kinds of rather dramatic things?
Yeah, we are. And I've even had some problems myself. I haven't been out and about for a long time, and I've had a lot of problems with my actual nervous system. And I really do believe that this is in my nervous system. And there are times when I get very nervous for no reason at all. I mean, I've actually had panic attacks, and they're so out of my nature when I have them. I just they're really disabling. And I think for a lot of other people, when you think about it, we have to live in a whole different paradigm than everyone else. It is like the movie The Matrix, and that we're the people that have to go live, on an island by themselves and pretend that, we belong. But people don't treat us that way. I mean, we have to live a whole alternate lifestyle just to compensate for the neglect.
Yeah, that's true. Very
true. That's a lot of stress.
That's a huge amount of stress. Cliff, thanks for the update, my friend. Take care of yourself. Good to talk to you as always.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. And Jan, congratulations on your heroic research. Just amazing what you've done.
Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Take care. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Good night. All right, there you go. There's our latest update on Morg Ellens. And do go back and listen to the March 1st program with Dr. Ed Spencer. He deserves a lot of credit and praise for his support of Morg Ellens research and people who are dealing with this really hideous nightmare of a syndrome. All right, we'll be back tomorrow night. See you then.